Okay. You're going?
Yeah, we're recording right today is November 5th.
We're talking about the shooting of the late Inspector Henry J. Joe Garvin, sorry, please. Clark Banion, Bell of the Times, and I covered that story. The morning, he was shot in the morning on his way to work, either on Piper Boulevard, or he lived on Piper, on the Tracy side. He wasn't far from his home. A car drove alongside, and a shotgun blast was fired at Joe. He was alone and driving, Garvin was alone and driving his car, and he fell to the floor immediately as a protective action. He was hit. The bullets went on from the shotgun blast and killed a little girl on her way to school. And I think she was a girl. Better check. Maybe just seriously injured, but she was badly hurt at least. And then Garvin, of course, said he didn't see anyone. He didn't have any enemies. The usual thing. You know, it's so often people you interview that have been shot or their buildings have been blown up, and they can't imagine why, because they don't have an enemy in the world. And of course, you know better. You know that they know, but they just want to tell. Garvin had a lot of enemies. He was very rough on people. And there was a talk around town that when the Ferguson grand jury came into being several years later, after he shot, that one of his main purposes was to, quote, get Joe Garvin, and they didn't lay a glove on him. And the story was people were just afraid of him, afraid to testify. Of course, to be fair, there wasn't anything they could testify against him for having done wrong. But that was it. He was in a receiving hospital for quite a while recovering, and when he came back to duty, his assignment was, he was given another detective, and his assignment was to go out and find the people who shot him. He never found them. They were never found. There was a feud in the police department, Bert McPherson, another inspector, who had been Garvin's partner and had worked with him, and friend, had a great falling out. And we're a bitter enemy. And people at police headquarters told me that when the word that Joe was shot came in that particular morning in 1930, it must have been early, it was the winter, the first thing the person said is, my God, I'll be blamed for this. But now that's about it. We did the usual things on the story. You know, talked to people and people and people and couldn't find anyone who knew.
Well, did either the Times or any of the papers have a break on this story, or did it break evenly?
Not that I recall that they have any break. If they had a break, it would be on the shooting itself, and that would be the man at police headquarters who'd pick that up.
Yeah.
Because, as you know, having worked there, Bill, it would come into DB, what was then called a DB desk, right. Would happen first, and they notified the reporter.
Yeah.
So I don't recall any, because the break, what kind of break could there be? Description of a car, you'd get that by having reporters out in the neighborhood ringing doorbells. If the police hadn't already gotten it, you'd get it by the arrest or the capture or the persons who did it, and nobody was ever arrested or prosecuted for shooting them. There are theories galore as to why, but as there always are.
Right, you talked about the little girl who was killed.
Yeah, but I don't know if she was killed. I'm just, you didn't have that done.
I got that.
Did she die?
I'll tell you, we can look it up here. Here's a shakedown plot. He's shooting a Garvin Lade DeRiver gang. Garvin shot in
Ferry.
Schoolgirl
on street wounded.
Did she die later?
She probably will die, it says.
Critical.
Yeah. Now, I didn't follow her through because it wasn't really...
why don't we be safe and say critically?
Yeah, she was critically wounded.
Critically.
Well, you were wounded but not killed.
Oh, did I?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. That's probably true then.
Yeah. Then she said...
No, no, excuse me. You have Garvin wounded but not killed.
Oh, yeah.
The girl killed.
Well, I may be wrong. She might not have died.
You also have Garvin being given the assignment of finding out who did it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's, yeah, Ray just said that.
Was in all of the papers.
If you really need that point, I'll check it out for you.
What's her name? Is it the other there?
Let me see.
I know she was in the hospital in this evening,
Lois Bartlett, B-A-R-T-L-E-T-T.
Lois Bartlett.
She was on her way to school. Yeah. I can check that out anytime. I don't want to hop skip around too much, but there's some things I'd like to get cleared. And then I want you to give me a general description after that of how newspaper men like Carlisle and yourself and McIntyre and Armstrong and so on were able to live both in the world and with the underworld and not really create a situation where you're allowed to get bummed off yourself. Now, I don't, if you want, you can maybe talk a little bit on that subject since I brought it up. Mm-hmm. I know, you know, what Carlisle says. He's a great friend of Peter Licavoli and says he is yet today. And Joe Zarilli hates him. And so forth. Well, Jack didn't come through very clear to me how you could maintain the relationships.
Well, I can explain it, I think. At least as far as talk about myself. And this would apply to Jack. And would apply to some of those other guys had a lot of enemies. But Jack got along pretty well. Is this on?
Yeah.
Am I talking? I think I can explain how that worked because of two things. One, we would never, never break a confidence. We would never tell the cops what the robbers were doing or the robbers what the cops were doing. Now, you see, it was our job to be crime newspaper men. We were working in that area, although we worked in many other areas as well. And just as this sports writer has to know the athletes in the society, writer has to know the people in society, we had to know the cops and the robbers. And I think that number one was that we would never break a confidence, would never tell, you know, Macy what Gimbel's doing. And number two, we would never accept a cup of coffee, even. If we were someplace and somebody, a cop or a robber, came in and bought us a drink, we'd boom, buy a drink right back again. I mean, it was never, it was always on a business basis. The third thing would be to try, and I think all of us did, to who had that relationship, try to go right down the middle and turn both sides of the story. Now, you know, we all know that the police who have, well, and law enforcement, who have a great deal of say to the papers, you know, about a crime, because the criminal isn't going to talk much, they usually do the best they can to get their best licks in, realizing the importance of public opinion. And I think many of us tried to point out to the other side because we knew the public would be interested in their side of the thing. Look, this is probably your last opportunity to talk to. I mean, I've said to people in connection with crimes, the people who are going to sit in the jury are going to read now what you've got to say, and this is the last time they're going to hear anything more about you unless you take the stand during your trial. And this is your chance if you want to take it. So it was to print both sides and try to be fair about it.
All right. Now, we know the town was, you know, wide open as far as bootlegging is concerned.
Bootlegging, handbook, crap games, prostitution. It was an open city.
And you know you could walk right across the street from the police headquarters and go into a blind pig. And at the news, I think we had 3 blind pigs within a stone's throw.
One direct.
And a whorehouse right on the corner.
Yeah.
Knowing all this, what was the newspaper's attitude about these places operating? I mean, did we try to close them up? It's difficult for me going back over the years to figure out what the hell. Occasionally there'd be a raid.
Well, what happened was this. The Free Press would occasionally blast away at an illegal enterprise, maybe one. The news would go on periodic crusades in Macomb County and Detroit against blind pigs, maybe, but usually against gambling. The Times was completely indifferent, feeling that we were not a law enforcement agency, that when the police did it or flagrantly failed to do it, we'd report it. But until some sin of commission, or I mean some commission, or some sin of omission was flagrant, we didn't do it. We didn't, you know, have crusades. The news, what, for instance, now I can't verify this story, except that at the time, I believe it was true, and I still believe it is true. Charlie Bowles was mayor, and of course, during that time, the city was in great turbulence while everything was going, gambling, prostitution, blind pigs, but that wasn't the first time in my life that it had been an open city. And the mayor, customarily, throws out the first baseball at the opening ball game. And I was told at the time that the news invited the mayor over to the roof of their building. It was a nice sunny day. And gave him a Tigers baseball cap and had him simulate throwing out the first ball. They were going to use this picture on the first on the opening day of the ball season. And they wanted to get it ahead of time so they could get it in an early enough edition. And he went over and went through the motions. Now, they wanted to get him out of the office so they could get a photographer in his office to take a picture of right across Monroe Street. That is Monroe that occurs around there, isn't it? From his office window of the biggest handbook in Detroit, in downtown Detroit, probably any place in Detroit. And that picture was splashed all over page one of the news of this handbook that you could see from the mayor's office. But the mayor, the implication was he was fiddling while Rome was burning. Whether there was a coincidence that the picture was taken when he was on the roof of the Detroit News or not, I don't know, but I'm told it was, and I assume things like this were commonly done. The news then would go on for several days with a cleanup of gambling in Detroit, and then it would just sort of fizzle out or drop off or something else would be more important. But of the three papers, I'd say the news was more crusading against vice. That isn't my time. And the Free Press, rarely. The Times, not at all. Unless some crime happened in connection with it, and then everything would be in the paper.
I want to shut this off a minute. You want to shut that off, because I want...
We were talking a little while ago about publicity and the the hoodlums' reaction to it. Now, I know that many could be, I've heard many could be canned. They were very vain people. We know they're vain, of course, most of them. Very vain, and they like to be made a lot of. But I don't know, in my experience, I've known a lot of lawbreakers, my God, hundreds, hoodlums, and I cannot think of one time when they tell me a story, tell me what had happened, where they wouldn't have, but remember, right, keep me out of it. And stories about, well, I did hear of a couple who retired and whose daughter got married and wanted her picture on the society page or something like that. But in connection with their exploits, no, my experience was always that they wanted to be kept completely out of it. And I think you'll, if you've read Gay Talese's last book, The Honor Thy Father, the same thing runs through his book, through his experience, was similar to mine. They tell me, and I'd often have to go out of my way to disguise the thing, to try to throw the source away from where it actually was, without implicating anybody else. But my, they didn't have a very keen sense or appreciation of public relations in that sense, because the hoodlums who got the most publicity, again, in my experience, and I'm limited to that. As I recall, the hoodlums who got the most publicity were the hoodlums who wound up in prison. The Joe Zarellis, who nobody got close to in the press, and who was reputed to be a very big man in the country as well as in this area, stayed out of the papers. And the ones that were getting all the ink were the ones that got in trouble, it seemed to me.
Ray, would it be too far-fetched to speculate that the roots of the organized crime today may have been seeded during Prohibition?
Well, as we know it, perhaps, at least a lot of the people who are wealthy and occupy fairly high positions in the underworld today got their start in Prohibition. I remember, I knew some of these fellows when they had a turtleneck sweater and a pistol under their belt and $2 in their pocket and a lot of goddamn nerve. But by, clawing and kicking and biting and shooting, they acquired. And they then branched out into other things. They got into gambling, and they got into jukeboxes. They got into legitimate business. Their offspring got into legitimate business. But see, a lot of these very wealthy hoods today started from really scratch, from the other side of the tracks, with nothing. And they made it on their own. They made it the very hard way. I think of the names that used to be in the paper so often in Detroit of Joe Massey, for instance. You mentioned Pete Lucifoli. He and his brother Yanni and Joe Bomarito came up here from St. Louis. They didn't have anything. Either the local or the imported ones had nothing. The Purples, when they disintegrated, and they died. Some of them had acquired some money. They all started off. Most of them started off. There were a few exceptions. Most of them started off with absolutely nothing. Well, the kids started with nothing. The families of a couple of them were another high middle class in Detroit.
Do you more or less agree that to have organized crime, you need a common vice denominator? Like you had, we had booze during Prohibition.
Yeah.
We had the anti-gambling laws, so this gave a denominator, an area in which they could work illegally. And today, I suppose you would say it'd be dope, would it not?
Apparently, in the last 3 years or so, it's gotten to be dope. Now, I have reason to believe that for many years, for many years, including the last 3 years, in Detroit, that organized crime as we knew it in the Prohibition days, and then later when gambling was taken over by some of the same people, was not controlled by what we call organized crime. I don't think that, and I'm not as close to it as I was, but I don't think an organization controls dope in Detroit or any place I know of today. And somebody's opened the floodgates in the last 3 or 4 years in narcotics, because all the big cities are flooded with it. Mm-hmm. But so far as Detroit goes, I think this is true in other cities, and I gather this from talking to people who are in a position to know, that as law enforcement people, it's split up. And that's why we're experiencing so many murders, I think, in Detroit, one of the reasons. So many murders in Detroit. So many of them this year are dope connected, and there's a parallel between the gangs fighting to control dope and the gangs which used to fight.
Joe Territorial Wars.
Right. Yeah. In Prohibition.
Yeah.
And gambling.
Yeah.
And it existed in that sense there was a common denominator. But organized crime as we know it, in the conventional way we think about it, has changed. New people are taking over narcotics. Now, I don't know if they're bringing it into this country. I don't know about that. But I think they're bringing it into Detroit, and they're controlling it after it gets into Detroit. Prostitution is not an organized thing. There isn't one big ring of prostitution, black or white. There again, you can have your individual enterprise, as you can in narcotics. Now, you're subject, of course, to shakedown. You're subject to being robbed. You're subject to extortion, all sorts of those things. But as far as, look, if you open a bar boot game in Detroit, say you could get away with it, and you have one going, somebody would be around and say, hey, you close this up. I run all the bar boom in Detroit. Now, that person used to be Pete Corrado. He's dead. We haven't had bar boom. I wouldn't let it run when I was police commissioner, because it's the most dangerous game. I mean, people can get hurt the most. But when Barbuda's running, one person runs it, and nobody else can run unless he's a partner and he permits it. Dice, sort of other things. But I don't think that applies to prostitution. I don't think it applies to narcotics. I think if we had 5 girls apiece, we could work them without being put out of business by a ring or a gang. If we had narcotics, if we were big importers of heroin, for instance, to Detroit, we could find our outlets without, and other people would be doing the same thing. No, there's no monopoly on either of those. And I don't think that there has been an awful lot of years, if even then. Now, organized crime, in a sense, if there is a, here we go, you know, one of these somatic things, if there is a mafia, I don't know. I've been around this thing, as you know, a long time, Bill, and I don't know today if there is. I think you gotta, to know, you gotta be born one. But there's something, loosely or tightly knit organization, undoubtedly. And I think in some areas, they do deal in narcotics. Some may deal even in prostitution, although both of those are generally frowned on. Or some member might be getting away with it. But I don't think that's happened in Detroit in one hell of a lot of years, if it happened then.
I guess the only reason you might think it'd be in dope is that there's such a mass movement of dope, you wonder how disjointed, unorganized people could bring it in.
Yeah, but they can have there can be a lot of sources outside Detroit, a lot of suppliers outside.
Yeah.
Who either send it or people go out and bring it from them. But I don't think it's one. There may be, it's possible that there is a top echelon in control of the imports of narcotics.
Mm-hmm.
But that would be just the kind. Of course, another problem that's peculiar to these last few years now in the narcotic area is the synthetic drugs. And, you know, LSD and the various other things. And the kids, they're made, right? Can be made, sure, in a laboratory or in a basement.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're on a pretty good area here because the big stories that are constantly recounted in the papers are the Buckley murder, of course, and the Collingwood massacre.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just about, what is it, about 6-8 months ago, we had 7 people killed in one house.
In Hazelwood.
Right, in Hazelwood. Which makes you wonder if that wouldn't have to be a gang affair or a ritualistic type thing.
Well, the only really ritualistic murder, and it's one of the papers of sort of, at least either I've missed it or they've missed it, I haven't read about it, was the Benny Evangelista murders in 1929, when something like 11 people in a home that was all weirdly decorated had their heads cut off and were murdered in very strange ways indeed. And when they're talking about big murders in Detroit, they missed that one. And
Was that Detroit?
Yeah, and it was 1929. I know I was in Europe. It was the summer.
Excuse me, Ray, was that the Witch of Del Rey?
No, that was Rose Varis. I covered that, too. Rose Varis had insured her rumors. She was a Hungarian woman. She insured men rumors in her home, and was convicted of murder in one case. But apparently she had a habit of finding something wrong with the roof and getting him to go up on a ladder, and then the windstorm would knock the ladder over and break their neck after the insurance was in proper order. So she was dubbed the Witch of Del Rey. Her name was Rose Varis. She's a little woman, weighed about 90 pounds. And her son, around 16, I never thought that had anything to do with any of it at all. But he got some sort of a conviction out of it. He spent 5 years or so in jail, prison. My monologue.
Am I keeping you too long, Ray? Soon you get tired, just yell.
Yeah, we'll take a break.
Okay.
I kind of like to.
Okay.
Reminisce of it.
I'm fascinated by this thing because I postulated a couple years ago that these dope things are going to end up in beer wars. You know, like the territorial beer wars.
That's what's happening. Flack, you know.
And all black. Yeah. And when the 7 was killed, I said, gee, this tops the Collingwood massacre.
Yeah, and it topped by one, the fish market.
Right. And yet, we never went overboard, I guess it would be the word, on the 7 And I'm sure it's not because they're black, because I think blacks now get as much attention as whites, maybe more, in the crime area. But gee, the Collingwood massacre and the fish market murder, you know, geez, they went on for days and weeks in the newspapers. But I wonder, Ray, if that's because in that era, the newspaper was the
only
medium of...
That's part of it, I think. The only thing part of it, too, is the crime wasn't as commonplace and as acceptable. Look, we got, what is it, 580 murders now, 580 up to this point.
People are getting used to this.
It's unfortunate.
They don't fail you anymore.
Back and they were raising hell.
Get you some more, Mark?
I'll take it. I was came across some clippings. They're raising hell with me.
How about you?
When I was police commissioner, I think this was 1965, because we had 166 murders, and you know, this was a terrible thing. Well, you can't. Police can't control murder as a rule. I think gang murders, robbery murders, and narcotic murders, the police can be more involved, and certainly they can in the family things.
Wasn't there another factor in the Collingwood massacre, and that is arrests were quickly made, and that kept the story going?
Yeah, and it was Purple Gang. And the Purple Gang, if they'd spit in the sidewalk, it'd be a story. They were new. And built, in my opinion, out of proportion. But, yeah, they're all arrested within a few days, except Fleischer. And then he helped keep it alive, the search for him.
Ray,
seems to me I spent half my life flying around the country looking for Fleischer, for the Lindbergh kidnapping, for the Collingwood thing, for gee. I was always going on an airplane looking for a Fleischer.
This is what I want you to say, because I was wondering if, you know, the Collingwood and fish market and so on recalled to your mind any of these newspaper men stories, you know.
Well, one newspaper man story was Beresford and Carlisle. I'd... Goodrich, Merton Ward Goodrich, who killed a little girl, was arrested in Terre Haute, Indiana. The Detroit News at that time had a beautiful airplane. Do you remember that, Bill? The plane that...
Yeah, the blue...
What was it?
Early Bird.
Yeah. Well, it was... Jesus, it was great to fly reporters to stories, except for one thing. As other pilots out there used to say, they wouldn't take it off the ground if there was a pigeon in the field around, or if the weather was, you know, the least bit inclement, they were going to protect that damn thing. So, and we used to go up in things made out of orange crates and anything we could rent. So, Harry Carter Dickinson, wait a minute, Goodrich, was arrested in New York, and I got back there. And to go back beyond that, Hard Carter Dickinson had been murdered in Detroit. He was a New York attorney, and they arrested in Terre Haute, Indiana, three girls, two of them sisters, and a man who did it. Were convicted of it later. So we flew down, but the news wouldn't take off. And finally, Beresford and Carlisle got there. Well, I was lucky when I got there. I ran into a cop I knew. Yeah, when I got to Terre Haute, he took me and I talked to all of the people, and you know, these red carpet. So Beresford and Carlisle got there. Oh God! Hours later, I don't know why we were still there. As a matter of fact, well, we hadn't come home. Yes, I do, because we're going to drive back with the prisoners, and they had extradition and phone. So when they got there, it was a Saturday afternoon. And I said, come on. So I took them, gave them the whole, laid it all out, introduced them to people, got their stories. So, you know, otherwise they'd have been floundering around at midnight or so. So just a short time after that, like a couple of weeks or so after the trial, a week or after the trial, they got Goodrich in New York. And we flew down, and the news beat us. It was a nice day, and they were, Jack was there. And I knew what hotel, the thing I wanted to do as soon as I got off that plane was to get a hold of the detectives from Detroit who went down the news plane. So I called the room, and geez, they were just, oh no, I had Arnold Freeman. Do you remember that photographer in the Times? I was drawing one place. I said, call that room and get Branton and Schweitzer and tell them, keep them on the line. I want to talk to him. So he called, and he came back while I was just finishing my call, and he had a weird look on his face, and he says, they said that made you at the 126th precinct. And I says, that's Carl. That son of a bitch that I just helped in Fort Wayne. So I jumped in the cab and raced back. Gave the driver a lot more money to get over there, the New Yorker Hotel. And the two coppers, Brandon's wife, were just coming out to the door. And they said, Ray, when did you get in? You know, I said, well, you son of a bitch. And I was wrong. They didn't know a thing about it. They had left the room, seen left Carl out there. He answered the phone, and boom, he was going to get rid of us in a hurry. They were on their way out to see the mother of one of them who lived in Brooklyn. So I'd have been all night, you know, floundering. But I got an awful lot of bail from them. But then, just another few weeks after that, a baseball player, big league player, was released in the middle, you know, before the end of the season. Not from the Tigers, from some other team. He came up to Detroit, and he went out to City Airport, and he chartered a plane to take him up, well, at any rate, where he's going, I don't remember, but over Toronto. The next morning, the people looked up in the sky, and they see an airplane going all over the goddamn sky. He'd gone berserk. He was drunk on the plane. The flyer had taken a friend along just for the ride, and the two of them beat him to death. They had to kill him to keep him from killing them with a fire extinguisher. And this is where the fight's going on. All the things going on. So we drew him fly up to Toronto. Now, they're in jail. They kill this guy to save their lives. There's no question about that. But nevertheless, Canadian law, they're in the can. So right away, you can't get in those jails, you know, without either paying off or something. So right away, I find out their attorney is and grab him. He's a big Irishman named Murphy, and he was the Queen of King's Counsel. He was in private practice, and he was very well known there. And a nice guy, and he liked whiskey. So I said, come on, Murphy, let's see when I get a drink, and then we'll talk. So I see he likes a drink. So I said, number one, I want to go and talk to these guys. I want to go in the jail. He says, well, I'll tell you what you can do for them. He said, they need some clothes. I said, you think I'm going to buy them suits of clothes and some damn bumps? And talk to them, I'll make it up first. No, he says, a pawn shop, what the hell? $10 for one suit? He says, can you go for that? So we went over to a pawn shop and bought a suit for $10, and I don't know, a hat or something, and took it over. And he took me in the jail with him, and I had a long, you know, go-by-go interview. So I got it, phoned it in. I phoned it because it was afternoon. And we go back down to my room in the hotel where we're drinking. Phone rings, it's Carla. He says, Murphy answered, see, and he put his hand over. He says, some guy named Carla. I says, tell him we'll meet him at the 126th precinct in the hangar. He says, we'll meet you at the 126th precinct, boom, and out we went. But these things were constantly going on, and yet we remained friends, and I don't know how. I saw Jack, I hadn't seen him when we got back to Detroit, and didn't mention, well, I guess I didn't see him for weeks, and he said, I've been telling Fritz Gardner something about that SOB and the times that kept him up all night so he could get in. He eventually got in some way, and that's, he wouldn't give up, you know, he stayed up all night and got in to see them the next morning. That's a kind of
report. How would you, I read a lot of stuff, including a story, you probably remember it, Michigan, Soust, but happy, I forgot. And it was part of a guy wrote this story in a magazine called Plain Talk.
Oh, G.D. Eaton, I knew him.
Soust, and I can't remember that.
G.D. Eaton was the other rebel.
Yeah, and a great...
Well, we were the anarchists, or he was a campus anarchist. And I was in school out there then, and I knew Eaton. He was truly an intellect. And his Mencken, of course, thought he was next to God. And he wrote a book, and incidentally, it was a good book. This was after. He was older than we were, quite a bit. And after he got out of school, he wrote, it was a novel. And it was a good novel, but it never went anyplace. Back Furrow was the title. Back Furrow, F-U-R-R-O-W. You probably knew his brother, but didn't know he's his brother. Bill Eaton, the state police.
Oh, I know the name, yeah.
Yeah, he was a lieutenant in the state police, and he was just the opposite. He and the King's English were mortal enemies from birth. Bill was a very good guy, a very conservative guy. Eaton was brilliant, and Plain Talk was a newspaper that he got out. I wrote a couple of things for it. And he was, you know, being beaten up by the athletes on a queue every once in a while. University of Michigan, Uber, all that. But Eaton was a very brilliant guy that did write for the, occasionally had pieces in the Mercury. When Mencken had it with, and Mencken was constantly writing about him, but he didn't, he had that one novel, and then he died. GDE, his initials, goddamn everything.
I'm going to switch tapes right now. There it goes.
One recollection that stands, that stays with me, and sometimes haunts me, is going out on fast-breaking stories, big stories, and alone from the Times, and finding 12 top-flight news reporters there. We were usually outnumbered about that. Or I might have one other, you know, guy or gal with me, Vera Brown, perhaps. But and I sometimes wondered which was easier, working against Vera, because I did that when she was on the news, or working with her when she was in the Times. You know, they're both so tough. She was tough either way. But sometimes we'd be together. But we were outnumbered, like you're up against the Russian army every time you turn around your trip. We used to console ourselves, and this, or rationalize it, or keep our sanity by saying to ourselves, look, this is good, we're lucky, because what they're doing is duplicating, and nobody knows what the other one's doing. Now, this was really far-fetched, but it kept us sane. Working against such numbers on a story that would be spread out, and you'd have to, like the Ypsilanti torch murder, for instance. When the Times, and I assume it was the same with the news, the presses didn't stop all day. We just kept putting out extra after extra after extra. It was breaking so fast, and it was going so fast that I saw Jim Swinehart, who weighed, remember Jim? Must have weighed 250, and he wasn't very tall, certainly not tall for that weight, I saw him actually run, and he was then in his, like, mid-50s, running down the street in Atlanta, you know. Everybody was doing those on the dead, stories on the dead run. But the news was, had a lot of good reporters. A lot of them. They were all good. And they had so damn many of them that they just flopped us. We had to be lucky, which we were sometimes. In order to compete. And on a breaking story, on a fast breaking story, we usually did pretty well with the news. Free Press all by itself at night. I haven't talked much about them because, well, they had good reporters. They didn't have to be so damn fleet-footed as we did.
No,
they had all day to get it.
Yeah, or they could rewrite you another
cabin.
They
just pick up and rewrite us, yeah. As I said, I so many times we'd be killing ourselves all day, and then McCormick would show up just before his last edition, the whole thing would break. And it'd be too late for us, and he'd have it. It was interesting.
It was
a wonderful life because you're constantly, without. There's an era of madness, of complete madness, if we're talking about journalism in Detroit. And that was a year that a tabloid called The Daily published and was followed by a year by The Mirror. Now, The Daily was running on a shoestring, but they were tabloid, using all the wild tabloid tricks of the early 30s. You know, this is one of the graphic, all the New York...